For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a special Christmas edition of Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week we're full of festive fun. Author and illustrator Charlie Mackesy discusses turning his beautiful graphic novel, The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse, into a magical audio experience. Joanna Toy transports us back to Christmas 1943 for the latest instalment in her Shop Girls series. And narrator Emma Powell takes us into her home studio to reveal how she's seeing fairy tales differently this Christmas. That's all coming up in today's special Yuletide Read On. Once in a blue moon, a book is published that is both beautiful and has universal appeal. When that happens, those of us who can't see to read can only hope that, if an audiobook version is made, it's as good as the print copy. This task is made even harder if the book is illustrated. But, to my mind, my next guest has just set a new benchmark in creating a modern classic that's accessible to all. Charlie Mackesy's book, The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse, has been winning hearts across generations and continents throughout this most difficult of years. And now, just in time for Christmas, Charlie has recorded a captivating audiobook version so that print-disabled readers can share its message of kindness, friendship and hope. And for me, Christmas has come early because Charlie joins us for this special festive edition of Read On.
Hello. Welcome to The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse by Charlie Mackesy. This audiobook is dedicated to my lovely mum and my wonderful dog, Dill. And to you, wherever you are. Thank you for listening.
Charlie Mackesy, welcome to this Christmas special edition of Read On.
Thanks for having me.
For anybody who hasn't yet entered the beautiful world of The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse, can you just give them a quick introduction?
I'll try. It's a kind of graphic novel, really. It's 75% pictures. And it's a story about a boy who meets a mole, who then the two of them have an uncomfortable meeting with a fox, and they go through some struggles and then become friends. And then finally they meet a horse. But really the narrative is in the conversation, and they talk about things we tend not to talk about, or the fears or worries. And they've discovered that their journey into vulnerability brings deep connection. And so it's a journey of connection and the journey into ourselves, into self-acceptance and love and all those things which I have struggled with, but enjoy talking about and drawing and writing about. So yeah, it's an odd book and one that was difficult to make, actually, because the drawings came together independently of any idea of a book. There was a narrative, but I just had to dig deep for it and then arrange the drawings in the right order. So the book is one that you can open on any page, really, and it sits in its own right. It's not necessarily part of the story, but that was the dream. Because actually, for me, I'm not very good at reading books, so I've always liked to open a book anywhere and read a bit of it. I have quite serious ADHD, so it's always been a struggle to make it through any book. So yeah, in a nutshell, it's a simple book about relationships of a boy and three creatures.
In the introduction that you've recorded for this wonderful audiobook version, you are very honest that you have problems with reading. Mm-hmm. And you say that pictures are islands in a sea of words for you. You also say how profoundly important it was for you that an audiobook version should be available to people who have print disabilities.
Yes, or people who can't see the pages or who struggle to read, yeah. I made it from a desire to create something that I wish I could have read when I was little or when I was 30. When we cook sometimes for ourselves, we cook something that we would really like to eat and then maybe share. And I suppose I drew something that I felt I would have loved to have read, and then perhaps other people might too, but I wasn't sure. I loved Tintin and I loved graphic novels, asterisks. I liked anything that wasn't too wordy. And in the introduction, I do say that pictures are like islands. I say music is like an island as well. So for me, making the audiobook, it was so crucial to have music, because music for me is as important as words. And it was such a privilege and a treat to be able to read it alongside Max Richter's sounds, because I think it introduces you to a whole other dimension of emotion and inner landscape. It's so powerful, music, for me. And I've drifted off the question, but anyway, sorry. There you go. A graphic example of my inability to stay on any point.
Do you have any links to sight loss amongst family or friends?
Yes, I have a very good friend who was in a car accident and lost his sight for quite a long time. He slowly came back, but I saw him every day and kind of vicariously lived through his experience. He went from having 20/20 pretty good vision to nothing overnight, and I think that was a terrifying thing for him and me for obvious reasons. But yeah, so I spent a lot of time sitting with him and watching him move and the frustration and fear that he had, and it gave me a whole new understanding of what it was to be visually impaired. And then I had another friend who never saw. He was blind at birth. That again was a very different thing, obviously, and he was amazing to be with. The way he moved was so confident, and he was at ease with his surroundings. It was a very beautiful thing, and I just was so full of, I think, admiration for him, actually, because obviously he didn't know what it was to see. He didn't know what anything looked like or what looked like even mean, and so we used to talk about that, and he was very open about it all. Those two people in my life had quite an effect on me, and I think if the audiobook, if people who are visually impaired enjoy the book, that would be another landmark moment in my life. What a privilege that is.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
Yes, when I work, I listen to music and audiobooks at the same time from two different devices, which is probably why I put a lot of music in mine, because I do love hearing music and I do love stories, and often audiobooks don't have music.
It's a wonderfully atmospheric soundtrack, which is also illustrated by sounds of the English countryside. I know that you recorded the audiobook in a barn in Suffolk in the middle of lockdown. You paint rather a wonderful picture of yourself under a mound of cushions and duvets.
The more orthodox route would have been to have gone to a recording studio, but I look after my mum and I couldn't risk any kind of interaction with anyone, to be honest. So I recorded it here in the barn. I got some scaffolding poles and some wooden poles and some blankets and cushions, and I sort of built a cave I could sit in. And I was then sent the recording equipment, which took me a while to work out how to use, because I'm more of a paper and paint person. I'm not very good with buttons. So I eventually worked out how to use it and sat in my little cave, which continually collapsed actually. And Barney, my dachshund, used to crawl underneath without my realizing and then start snoring in the middle of recordings, or there's often bees used to get inside it. And if it wasn't that, then I was dealing with external noises of airplanes and lawnmowers and chainsaws. So it was quite an adventure for me to try to manage to do it in a way that was presentable.
Well, one of the messages in the book is that there is really no such thing as perfection, and that we should enjoy the imperfections in life. And it's beautifully illustrated by a crescent moon and I believe your dog's intervention.
Yes, I draw with ink and it takes about half an hour to dry, and I draw quite fast, so I tend to spread drawings everywhere and sometimes put them on the floor. And that drawing, that the mole says the greatest illusion is that life should be perfect. And Barney, the dachshund, did just walk straight across it and left these paw marks right across the drawing. And then there was another drawing. I drink a lot of tea and left a teacup on a piece of paper. And while I lifted it, it looked so perfect as the moon that I drew the characters below looking at it, asking if it was the moon. So yeah, I like to break the fourth wall and bring real things into the work.
Did you find that drawing pictures in words, narrating the audiobook, was very different to drawing those pictures by hand from your mind?
It was a very different thing. Yes, they say a picture speaks 1,000 words, and you can very quickly describe a landscape with a few lines, whereas words I find harder. And in a way, for me, the fact that it took so long because of my weakness with technology was a good thing in the end, because I wrote and rewrote and rewrote the words and tried to hone them down. I didn't want to get too wordy because the book is very simple and I didn't want the audiobook to be too wordy. So it did take time to paint pictures with words, and it was a thrill actually to describe the drawings with the music and then bring the words in also from the book. So all the words in the book are there, but I just filled it out with description. I described the colours of landscape and the colours of things and the trees. And yeah, in the end, I really loved it. I rediscovered the joy of words, actually.
Did you write yourself a script, or did you focus on the picture and describe it as if to a blind friend?
I did both. The problem with recording here was that often I would start recording something and I achieved what I thought was a good recording for a minute or so, and then it would be ruined by something, or they told me later that there was a central heating noise in the background, whatever. So I found that I would lose sentences that I thought I liked, you know. So I began without a script, but as time went by, when I liked certain things that had been said, I didn't want to lose them in case I re-recorded. So in the end, I did write a script, but there was no script to begin with. I'd lived and tried to describe it, as you say, to a blind friend. I think I began it in June, and I think it was only delivered in November. So it was a long journey. And I think I had 250 recorded files, of which was only one in the end.
It is a beautiful rendition of the book, and I think it really stands by itself as an artistic achievement, so that even if people have already bought the print copy, they will want to listen to the audiobook.
Well, that's a lovely thing to say. Thank you. When I heard the word audiobook, I just understood it to be someone sitting down and reading their book out loud. And to be truthful, if I did that, the audiobook would be very short, because essentially it's mainly pictures. So I realized that it couldn't just be that. And in the end, I decided to try and create an experience, sort of an album almost, like a piece of art. I wanted to be true to the book, but also it's a thing in its own right. I had a vague understanding how it'd be, but it sort of grew itself organically over time. But finding the right music was really difficult. And then when I found it, I found that that led the pace of the book. I think where we are now, there's a lot of anxiety. You know, media is quite rushed. Things are rushed. So I decided to make it very gentle and slow and just let people sink into it and find some kind of comfort and peace in the sounds. And of course, a book you can pick up and put down and read at your own pace. And I suppose in an audiobook, you can pause it, obviously. But I think the pace of it was crucial to me, and the rhythm of it. And all those things took a long time. But I remember playing it, bits of it, to friends during that time. And they were surprised that, oh, gosh, it's not really an audiobook, is it? Was the usual kind of response. What is this? It's like, you know, you've got all these bird sounds and river sounds and this music. And when I listen to audiobooks, sometimes I do lose concentration and I need islands or breaks or some kind of reward for listening. And so I try to do that. Because I suppose it's for any age, you know, a four-year-old or a 94-year-old. It's trying to meet people wherever they are in their timeline.
Yes, it's full of life lessons we might have learned when we were very young, but actually we need to remember as we go through life. My particular favourite is that time spent with friends is never wasted.
Yeah.
And you allow space for those words to sink in before moving to the next page, just as I remember my mother doing when she read me books like Aesop's Fables when I was very little.
Yes, that's well observed. I suppose the book is things concentrated. I kind of got a sieve and tried to sieve out the things that I felt mattered. And so the book became drawings with little conversations that led to a punchline, I suppose, of importance. And as you say, when we get to one of those sentences, I felt like it was crucial to leave space around the statement to let it be absorbed. Now, I think a long period of silence would have been no good, which is why I thought music was a good way of allowing things to sink in without the yawning silences.
The four characters, the boy, the mole, the fox and the horse, are all different aspects of each of us. The boy is curious, but a bit scared. The mole is greedy. The fox has been hurt and the horse is wise.
Yes. The four characters are very different and do represent certainly four parts of me. And I think they're four parts of the human condition, to a degree anyway. The fox is definitely hurt by life and therefore has struggles to trust and is withdrawn and is outwardly initially quite aggressive and misunderstood probably. And the boy is naive and full of questions. And the horse is the wise bit of us. And the mole is the part of me certainly that is always hungry for something, sort of insatiable on some level. But the mole is insatiable for cake. But it's that kind of, I need something now, quickly, that sort of feeling. So yeah, I think there's definitely four parts of me. But it was interesting to the audio bit because I got to discover them more deeply. You know, I could think about the characters more. The fox is very present in the audiobook, quite central presence rather than in the book. You know, it seems to be less noticeable. That interests me, actually.
Isabel Waller-Bridge has composed some music specifically for the fox, for the audiobook, which is very arresting.
Yes. So we talked a lot about the presence of the fox and what feelings that would create if you were a timid mole and a boy who was scared of foxes. And so it was really fun doing that because she would send files through and say, you know, how do you feel about this? And that was something I've never done before. And it was in my wildest dreams, actually, to be able to write an event that someone would write music for was wonderful.
After that, the boy, the mole, the fox and the horse become inseparable. They spend a long time just playing and messing about. The boy reaches high and puts the mole on the horse's back, climbs up and sits next to him. He lies with the mole and then turns to sit facing back to front. He does handstands and even manages some pirouettes. The fox walks, circles them, lies and sits around looking up at the mole. Sometimes he does figures of eight through the horse's legs. This goes on for quite a while. Then they show the horse their favorite tree. And the boy stops and turns. Doing nothing with friends. It's never doing nothing, is it? No, said the mole.
My guest, Charlie Mackesy, narrating his book, The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse. The book has become somewhat of an international sensation, partly because of lockdown, and quotes and pictures from it have appeared on t-shirts, school walls, even as NHS screensavers to remind us to be kind, to be patient, and that whilst the world is a wild place, it's our reaction to it that governs how we feel. You must feel immensely proud that it has chimed with so many people during such tense times.
Yeah, I would definitely say it's one of the greatest privileges of my life to discover that the NHS had put the drawings on their internal screensavers and that they were printing them out and putting them on ward walls, and then they were printed out and put on lampposts in LA and Melbourne and South Africa, you know, wherever I kept hearing or seeing people sending me images. You know, when you feel that you can make marks on paper that then help people get through a day, I can't really think of a better feeling. A lot of my life as an artist has been some kind of monetary connection to a drawing or a painting. So it goes to a gallery and the gallery sell it, you know, the exchange is like that. Whereas this was a sort of liberation and people were just sticking them everywhere and printing them out. And I really loved that. I get messages from nurses in COVID wards saying they're around and they're also in the staff meeting room where they have coffee. And there were new drawings that weren't in the book that I did specially for them. They were the same characters, but there's one that I wrote that's there was a sort of rainbow in a dark cloud, and the boy was asking the horse, what's the best thing you've learned about storms? And the horse said that they end. And to see that go viral and go in shop windows, and they blew it up and put it on school windows so kids who were walking past could see that there was an end to this. And I found that very, very moving. Like, of all the things I've ever done, that felt like the loveliest thing. And I'd often find myself tearing up at the thought of it all, you know, because it's a strange place to find yourself.
And that asking for help is not giving up. It's refusing to give up, which is a message that I think we're all taking out of 2020.
Yes. I've been thinking a lot about the fox and how the fox is the least likely character to ask for help. And there's a sort of an independence in the fox and a pride in the fox. Not that he does in the book, but I think he will in future. And certainly as an English male, I've struggled to be weak and be open about the things that concern me. And I think a crisis like this can help us open up, probably.
Well, I'm sure it will be finding its way into many a Christmas stocking in print and audio form. And I will wish you a very happy Christmas. And let's all hope for a kinder 2021.
Happy Christmas to you too. Thanks for having me.
The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse is available commercially and should be entering the RNIB Talking Books Library soon. And Charlie will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life. You're listening to a Christmas special episode of Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, we go behind the scenes for the recording of Red and the Wolf, the RNIB's Christmas read-along fairy tale. But first...
As regular listeners will know, Joanna Toy's Shop Girl series follows the staff of Marlowe's, a fictitious department store in the Midlands, as they battle to keep life running as normally as possible during World War II. The fourth book in the series, Christmas for the Shop Girls, has just entered the RNIB library and is a festive treat packed with drama, resilience and romance, adding a very necessary bit of sparkle to this bleak midwinter. Joanna Toy, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you.
Christmas for the Shop Girls begins on Christmas Eve with a bit of a bang.
Yes, it does, really. In a way, it's a flashback to the end of the previous book, Heartache for the Shop Girls. And the war very much comes home to Hinton, my heroine Lily's hometown, when there's a bomb. She and her young man, Jim, are actually in the store where they both work, and they are caught in the blast. So the rest of the book is a kind of a case of take it from there.
And Lily's having to deal with a little bit of shell shock, but also trying even more than usual to make life normal during very challenging times.
Yes, the thing is that Lily and Jim were actually buried in the blast, and I didn't want to minimize the effect that that would have on them, even as time goes on. So there's an awful lot to cope with, really, and they've got to deal with their own emotions. They were both injured. And, of course, the store, Marlowe's, where they both work and where they have a lot invested emotionally, has been badly damaged. So there's quite a lot of repairing to do on every level.
As ever, the store, Marlowe's, this wonderful Edwardian emporium, is a huge character in the book. And as you say, really has taken a bit of a battering in the 3.5 years of the war so far.
That's right. I mean, what we've seen in the previous three books is the difficulties of keeping a store going, getting enough stock, keeping the staff, because young men were being called up, women too, the slightly older ones. Lily is not yet quite 18, so that's not an issue for her. But it's become very difficult to run a retail business. The challenge of actually replacing the fabric of a building, very, very difficult. And Marlowe's actually come up with a very ingenious suggestion. Four of their ground floor windows were blown out. And without giving too much away, those are turned into little tiny independent shop units because you can't get a huge sheet of plate glass. So a smaller piece of glass and then a little window and door to enter a small shop unit is feasible.
And that presents opportunity for one of the members of the cast to strike out by herself.
Yes, that's right. From the beginning of this series, back in a store at war, we met three shop girls, Lily, Gladys, her friend, and Beryl. And Beryl's always had quite a lot of get up and go about her. Lily's not exactly not feisty, but Beryl's the cheeky one, really. And she has talked herself into one of these shop units with a little bridal hire business. Because with clothes rationed, it was very, very difficult to get hold of anything new. So the idea of having a second-hand, a borrowed wedding dress or a rented wedding dress was a really quite a good one.
An air of resilience and resourcefulness really streams through this book. It's very much about making the best of a bad situation and finding things to keep you occupied rather than dwelling on how bad things can seem. And I wondered if it was easier to write this book surrounded by the lockdown measures that we have, if you were able to sort of channel that.
That's really interesting. The book was written in very strange circumstances, really, and certainly edited during lockdown. The whole production process has been hugely affected by it. I couldn't help making the comparison, inevitably. Of course, people are suffering now mentally, physically. It's very difficult to be apart from those you love. But relatively, what we have been through, are going through, is a very short time span. We're talking about 6 years of war here with relentless strain and very little communication possible with people who were far away, people going missing, hearing nothing for months, certainly about men who'd been taken prisoner. It's almost unimaginable to me, actually, what went on. I mean, I don't want to make it sound miserable because, as you say, the characters do just cling on to whatever they can. I mean, Lily's got this mantra, which is three good things every day that, you know, she tries to write down, three good things that have happened. It was simple things like that, I think, that kept people going. There was a great sense of community, which certainly during the first lockdown, we all exhibited here again. So you have to hope that we can find something of that keep calm and carry on spirit.
Absolutely. And I love the sense of community that is built in this shop that keeps everybody in a job, but also keeps them all busy. And yes, there are fallings out and so on and so forth, but it's a community centre and it can produce real happiness and joy, as with the fashion show that happens towards the beginning of the book, which just made me smile and really did remind me of those Christmas pantomimes that we used to have in the village I grew up in, where everybody contributes something but is quietly keeping their fingers crossed that the stage curtain isn't going to collapse.
Yeah, there was very much an element of make do and mend about this fashion show because materials were in such short supply and many things get in the way of it happening. It actually reminded me, it's funny you should mention pantomimes, of the Archers pantomimes that happen every year, because I used to write for the Archers, with always some disaster had to strike. But they sort of do manage to produce success from disaster, and it turns into a really good evening. I mean, it's working as a sort of relaunch for Marlowe's store after the bomb and to showcase these utility fashions to show people that they weren't as dreary as people thought they were going to be. So there's a kind of social history point, but everybody, as you say, does pull together to make it a success in the end.
And I was going to ask you about the social history. I certainly learnt things as I was reading through the book, such as all women between the ages of 19 and 43 had to be in the volunteer services. And also some of the recipes for sausages made with lentils and root vegetables. I was wondering how far your research went. Did you cook these recipes yourself?
Didn't quite go that far, and I haven't yet tried to get hold of a tin of snook. Was that how you said it? That sort of greasy South African fish, a bit like herring or mackerel, that people used to have to eat. I absolutely love all the detail, and I think that the little touches like that are what makes the book authentic. And when I've spoken to people who were maybe even children during the war, they go, oh, I remember that. It was just endless carrot pie, carrot cake, carrot this, that and the other, because that was used as a sweetener when you couldn't get sugar. The research I really, really like, but of course you have to be quite a good self-editor not to put all of it in, because I think it's fascinating. But that's true, everybody was doing some form of war work, the women, and although 19 was the official age for call-up, you could volunteer earlier. There were many, many stories, of course, of people volunteering at 17, 18, fibbing about their age, and certainly in the early stages of war throughout, really, certainly till 43, where this book's set, being admitted into the forces or factory work because a really big workforce that was needed.
And once again, you've got the fantastic Becky Wright, herself, of course, a veteran of the Archers, narrating Christmas for the Shop Girls.
Yes, I'm so relieved and glad that Becky had a better time this time than recording the previous book, Heartache for the Shop Girls, which she recorded under lockdown conditions, doing it herself, as it were, on her home studio equipment. This time she was able to be in the studio, but she's so brilliant and professional, you actually can't tell the difference in the sound. And as ever, I've given her some new characters to just to stretch her a bit. You know, we don't want her getting complacent. So the Black Marketeer character is someone she's had to animate. And as ever, she's done a brilliant job with all the different voices.
"Well, sis, that's a bit of a blinder," he said, when she got hold of him and explained what she and Gladys wanted to do. There was a telephone at Sid's Diggs, and they spoke as often as they could, Lily from the telephone box by the chip shop. It wasn't just because Reg was away that Lily had become closer to the brother who was still within reach. She'd always been closer to Sid. They looked alike, tall and blue-eyed, with their mop of fair hair, while Reg had their mother's soft brown hair and eyes. But that wasn't all. Reg was quieter and more considered, also like their mother, while Sid and Lily were outgoing and adventurous, a personality inherited from the father Sid could hardly remember, and Lily had never known, who died when she was a baby. It was Sid who'd let Lily use the go-kart he'd made from an old orange box and a set of pram wheels, and had picked her up and been kind rather than cross when she flipped it over and bent the frame. Sid, who'd taken her scrumping apples from the big houses up on Cavendish Road, and had taken all the blame when their mum had found out. And, more recently, Sid, who'd entrusted her with some of his secrets. Secrets that no one else knew. "I know it's a lot to ask, but could we stay with you? Or if not, could you find us, I don't know, a hostel or something? Anything," she hazarded. "I know you're at work in the week, and so are we, but if me and Gladys can get a Saturday off together, we could come down on the train very early, stay over Saturday night, and come home on the Sunday." Saturdays off were highly prized by the Marlowe staff. "I see you've got it all worked out. What a surprise." "It's just an idea, Sid. I haven't told Gladys yet."
Becky Wright, narrating Christmas for the Shop Girls, written by my guest, Joanna Toy. There's quite a tension between loneliness and the desire for company in this book. Lily and Jim are now a couple and they're very happy. And all Lily wants for her widowed mother, Dora, is for her to be happy, even if that means moving on from her widowhood. Dora has always seemed very efficient, but are you warming towards her as an emotional character?
Yes, I wanted Dora, rather than just being a sort of dispenser of wisdom and food and cups of tea, to have a story of her own. And Dora is still quite a young woman. Like many people then, she had her family young. Lily's got two older brothers and are close in age. There's only 5 years between the eldest and Lily. And I imagine Dora was in her very early 20s when she had her first child. So having been widowed young, she's only in her early 40s. Now that is no age. And maybe Lily, now she has found her young man, it makes her more aware that it does make a difference when there's someone meaningful in your life who isn't purely family, someone who doesn't have to love you, as it were. So you're right, we find out more about Dora in this book, explore a bit of her emotional life. And I think it comes as quite a surprise to her almost. She can strike up this friendship, as she does, with a Canadian serviceman who's stationed in England. And I hope it's another sort of warm story to show that good things can and do happen when people are flung together in unusual circumstances.
It certainly is a very warm story, and as it progresses towards Christmas 1943, there is a real hope that romance could blossom. I don't want to give away any spoilers, but it is an incredibly warm-hearted book, which I think will make anybody curling up with it in front of the log fire this Christmas feel a great love for their fellow human beings.
That's very kind. That's what I really want from the books. I want people to enjoy them for what they are, which is a story about friendship and community and kindness and perseverance and self-reliance and all those things. But, you know, in the end, things do come good. There are various dramas that people have to get over. There is the recovery from the bomb, and something quite nasty happens within the store that has to be sorted out, a series of anonymous letters. Germany gets drawn into a black market scam. But people pull together, unite against a common enemy, and come through.
Yes, there's a wonderful feeling of hope that pervades the book. And it certainly warmed my heart as we approach Christmas. Now, this year's Christmas is going to be quite different from anything we've known before. And I was wondering if there are any Christmas traditions that you will be adhering to make it seem as normal as possible this year?
A tree, a big box of chocolates, and some form of entertainment, because we like to do some kind of charades or game or something like that.
And possibly listening to the Archers?
Possibly listening to the Archers, yes, that's right. Or curling up with a reread of Christmas for the Shop Girls, you know.
I think that's a fantastic plan. I'm sure many of the listeners will be curling up with Christmas for the Shop Girls as well, thanks to it being in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And thank you, Jo, for helping make this a very special Read On Christmas special.
Thank you very much, and a Merry Christmas.
All the books in Joanna Toy's Shop Girls series are available as Talking Books from the RNIB Library, where you'll also find a selection of her Archer's Chronicles.
Are you filming, Mum?
Yeah.
Hello, UK. My name is Kira, and I need your help with something. I love Christmas, but sometimes I'd feel left out of some of the magic. Blind kids like me will write to Santa, but Santa needs help writing back to us.
Because Santa can't write Braille.
But here's how you can help. If you text letter to 70597 to give £5 today, you could help RNIB and Santa send an accessible letter to a child this Christmas. Last year, Santa sent me a letter in Braille. He even told me I was on the nice list. Knew it! Thanks to RNIB and Santa, I felt included in the magic of Christmas too. Now, I want more of the 14,500 blind and partially sighted kids in the UK to feel the same. Please text today or search RNIB Christmas. RNIB. See Christmas differently.
Welcome back to this special festive edition of Read On. And now, before we return to hear the books of Charlie Mackesy's life, the gift of reading is one of the most empowering things you can give someone. And if you know a young child at the beginning of that adventure, here's a Christmas gift idea to help them learn to read independently, even if they have problems seeing the words.
Welcome to RNIB Read Along Stories. When you hear this sound, turn the page.
This Christmas, see fairy tales differently with RNIB and our new Read Along book. Red and the Wolf is a beautiful book, retelling the story of Little Red Riding Hood, but with a modern twist. And with a title like that, I needed to find out more. Like me, Red can't see very well, but that doesn't stop her overcoming the challenges that she faces. RNIB's Read Along book includes a children's storybook with accompanying audio, sound effects, and audio prompts to tell you when to turn the page. This means that children can listen to the story and follow the text to help them read independently. And I'm delighted to be joined by the book's narrator, Emma Powell.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You are no stranger to recording children's audiobooks for the RNIB Library. Tell us a bit about the recording of Red and the Wolf.
Oh, it was lovely, because it's a really good fun story, and I like the way that it kind of plays with your expectations. So you can do some really fun stuff with it. So there are certain twists and turns that you expect, but then it goes the other direction, and the character is feisty and fun and clever. So I loved it. I thought it was great. And I love the character of the wolf as well, that he's, again, not what you expect, and grandma's not what you expect. And yeah, I thought it was fantastic. And that you were also coming at things from a different angle. So I'm not used to reading kids' stories where the sound is so much of a clue, that it's giving you kind of ideas and clues into what's happening next and how she finds out what's happening.
As you say, Red is really quite feisty. She's a martial arts expert and uses all her street smarts, all the clues surrounding her, to outwit the wolf. And yet, the author of the book, Deborah Fagerman, said actually that the wolf is her favourite character. Did you have a favourite?
Oh, I don't know if I should say. I like doing the wolf because he has a funny voice and it's fun to do funny voices. But I like doing Grandma as well because she has quite a funny voice. And I liked Red's feistiness. But yeah, probably the wolf. It's always the baddie that you like the best, isn't it?
Sound of water rushing over rocks. I'm by the river. She then tapped her cane on a big rock. That's where she had to turn left into the wild woods. Suddenly, she heard footsteps. They came close to her and stopped.
Hello, little girl,
said the stranger. His raspy voice came from above her. A clue, he was tall.
Shall I guide you to Granny's cottage?
Luckily, Red wasn't the kind of girl who got scared easily. No thanks. I'm not allowed to talk to strangers, and I'm really good at finding my own way. He said and stomped off. Red heard a swishing noise. A clue. He had a long, swishy tail. In the distance, there was a splash. He had stepped in a puddle.
Oh, bother,
came his voice from far away.
It's a fantastically interactive book. It's kind of theatre for one, really, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. I think I would definitely have liked it as a kid, and I wanted to kind of give it to all my nieces and nephews, and my son's too old for it, but I think it's fantastic and would happily recommend it and hand it around.
Did you treat it a little bit like a theatre production? Because I know you've done an awful lot of work on stage.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't a kind of like quiet, intimate kind of read like you might have with some books. It was something that you could kind of get your teeth into and kind of ham up in a more theatrical way, yes. Hopefully not over the top, but in a way that kids enjoy. Having read to my son as he's been growing up, it's really good fun watching their faces and seeing your kids kind of get excited and drawn in by the story. So you just have to imagine some child listening, and it just comes naturally after that, as I'm sure any parent could tell you.
Absolutely. And you were rather a natural choice to read this book. You've done a fair amount of children's books over the years, many of them for the RNIB Talking Books Library. And I noticed some Enid Blyton in there, and also Roald Dahl's Rotten Food, along with Gary Rhodes.
Yes, that was fun. That was all kind of weird recipes from Roald Dahl. So in his books, when there's like worm cake or things like that, these kind of weird recipes, they found ways to kind of actually make them, not with real worms, obviously, but things that look like worms. So it was really funny. It was really good fun. And getting to know people at RNIB is so friendly, and I really enjoy coming in there.
Of course, unfortunately for this recording, you weren't able to go into the RNIB studios, and I believe you've got a set up at home.
I have. Thank the Lord. Yes, I have a booth and all of equipment and everything at home, and I had most of it before lockdown, but as soon as lockdown happened, I kind of upgraded it all so that I could continue working from home, and it was the best money I've ever spent. It was definitely a good choice. It can get hot in my booth at home. I don't have the kind of aircon that the RNIB has. And I do miss the crack, the Irish would say, and hanging out with people and chatting and sharing opinions about the book you're reading. Because most of the books I really enjoy, but there's the odd book that can be kind of painful. And so it's kind of fun and it helps when you've got someone jolling you along through it. But I don't miss the commute. It is nice just to kind of walk the 10 steps it takes to get into my studio. So, and when I go on the tube these days, which I do very rarely, it feels really loud to me. I'm not used to the noise and I kind of want to shut my ears off to it.
Well, you could always plug yourself into a good talking book.
I could. I need some decent headphones. I have to kind of press my headphones into my ears because I've got rubbish ones, but I need to sort that out, definitely.
Well, Christmas is coming and I know Red and the Wolf will be finding its way into an awful lot of Christmas stockings. So, Emma Powell, thank you so much for bringing it to life for those of us who can't see the pictures and for being a guest on the show.
It's my pleasure. And I really hope that lots of kids do hear it and do enjoy it. And it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
To find out more and order your copy for £8.99, which includes delivery within the UK, visit the website readalong.org.uk. That's readalong.org.uk.
Thanks again to Emma Powell. And you can find a full list of books that she's narrated for the RNIB Library by searching the website rniblibrary.com or calling the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Now it's back to Charlie Mackesy for the Books of His Life. Charlie, was there a book that you read as a boy or a young man that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I think there were a few books that really woke me up to the beauty of them. The first one, I think, was when I was very young. There was a writer and illustrator called Edward Ardizzone, who wrote a series of books and illustrated them called Tim All Alone, Tim at Sea. It was basically a boy called Tim who went on adventure. And the way he drew them, he's a very, very good artist, very good illustrator, and his words and drawings work together to put you in this place very easily that I could live in and escape to. I think I was given a book of his when I was probably 8, and I loved that series. And then when I just left school, as I said before, I'm not very good at reading books. You know, I do love reading bits of them, but I'm not very good at starting and finishing them. But one I remember I read effortlessly and ate through the words easily was Catcher in the Rye by Salinger. I always remember the sort of rebelliousness of his words. And I think his first sentence was something like, I suppose you're going to want to know where I was born and where I went to school and all that kind of crap, but I'm not going to tell you. And I remember thinking, wow, that's a whole new way of writing a book. In a way, he's the Robin Hood of words. He took them out of the hands of the cognoscenti and the controllers and gave a book back to the people who wouldn't normally read books. So I felt like his was a gift, and I read it regularly. And so that definitely affected me, not just emotionally, but also it opened up the world of books to me.
I'm the most terrific liar you ever saw in your life. It's awful. If I'm on my way to the store to buy a magazine, even, and somebody asks me where I'm going, I'm liable to say I'm going to the opera. It's terrible. So when I told old Spencer I had to go to the gym to get my equipment and stuff, that was a sheer lie. I don't even keep my goddamn equipment in the gym. Where I lived at Pensy, I lived in the Ossenberger Memorial Wing of the new dorms. It was only for juniors and seniors. I was a junior. My roommate was a senior. It was named after this guy Ossenberger that went to Pensy. He made a pot of dough in the undertaking business after he got out of Pensy. What he did, he started these undertaking parlors all over the country that you could get members of your family buried for about $5 apiece. You should see old Ossenberger. He probably just shoves them in a sack and dumps them in the river. Anyway, he gave Pensy a pile of dough, and they named our wing after him. The first football game of the year, he came up to the school in this big goddamn Cadillac, and we all had to stand up in the grandstand and give him a locomotive. That's a cheer. Then, the next morning, in chapel, he made a speech that lasted about 10 hours.
He started off with about 50 corny jokes just to show us what a regular guy he was. Very big deal. Then he started telling us how he was never ashamed when he was in some kind of trouble or something to get right down on his knees and pray to God.
John Chancer narrating The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
That's a really hard question because on rainy days I normally draw or watch a film. And when I read Odd Moments. But if I was going to, I read Birdsong by Sebastian Fox. And I think that book, again, was an intensely beautiful experience. It just, you know, sometimes the timing of books are perfect. And I remember when I first read that, I was on a plane, actually. And there was this moment where the protagonist, I think it's Stephen, I think he'd been underground in some trenches. And first of all, he'd been underground and the tunnel collapsed on him and he thought he'd made it back to the Allied lines. And as he surfaced like a mole gasping for air, he was dragged out and then he realized that they were German soldiers. And he tried to fight them, thought that he was going to be killed. And he reached for his pistols but had lost them. And they were grappling with him. And then he realized as the grappling was going on that he was trying to fight them and they were trying to hug him. And they were saying in German, the war is over. It's the only time in my life when I've read a book that I couldn't control my crying. And it was on a plane. People were looking at me as I was sobbing at this moment where there was this beautiful sense of the war was over. And they were trying to hug him rather than fight him. And I kind of feel now like where we are, that we've been at war with the virus. It feels like we're constantly at war with this hidden enemy. And I was thinking about Birdsong yesterday and how that moment when the fight ended and there was love, people could hug again. And I felt that was so significant. Even if I just read that bit now, it would give me hope that soon this war we're in will be over and we'll be able to hold each other and freely without fear of infection. So I'd probably read Birdsong just for that reason alone.
He fixed his eyes on Madame Azaire, who was sitting opposite. She was unable to hold his gaze, but looked down at her plate. Her discomfort did not deflect Bérard. Azaire was fiddling with his pipe, and Stephen studied the wall above Bérard's head. Madame Bérard watched with a proud smile as her husband made the gift of his song to his hostess. Madame Azaire blushed and squirmed in her chair under the unblinking stare of the singer. The dewlaps on his neck wobbled as he turned his head for emphasis at a touching part of the song. It was a sentimental ballad about the different times of a man's life. Its chorus ran, "But then I was young and the leaves were green. Now the corn is cut and the little boat sailed away." At the end of each refrain, Bérard would pause dramatically, and Stephen would allow his eyes a quick glance to see if he had finished. For a moment, there was utter silence in the hot dining room, but then would come another deep inhalation and a further verse. "One day the young men came back from the war. The corn was high and our sweethearts were waiting." Bérard's head revolved a little as he sang, and his voice grew louder as he warmed to the song. But his bloodshot eyes remained fixed on Madame Azaire, as though his head could turn only on the axis of his stare. By an effort of will, she appeared to compose herself and stiffen her body against the intimacy of his attention. "And the little boat sailed away."
"There," said Bérard, coming abruptly to an end. "I told you I should make a fool of myself."
The others all protested that, on the contrary, the song had been magnificent.
"Papa has a beautiful voice," said Madame Bérard, flushed with pride.
Peter Firth narrating Birdsong by Sebastian Fuchs, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Since doing this audiobook, the last book I really read was probably The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway, which is such a beautiful, simply, I think he's such a craftsman with words. And so I think it's a lovely book to read if you haven't read it. Yeah.
He was an old man who fished alone in a skiff in the Gulf Stream, and he had gone 84 days now without taking a fish. In the first 40 days, a boy had been with him, but after 40 days without a fish, The boy's parents had told him that the old man was now definitely and finally Salao, which is the worst form of unlucky. And the boy had gone at their orders in another boat, which caught 3 good fish the first week. It made the boy sad to see the old man come in each day with his skiff empty, and he always went down to help him carry either the coiled lines or the gaff and harpoon and the sail that was furled around the mast. The sail was patched with flour sacks, and furled, it looked like the flag of permanent defeat. The old man was thin and gaunt, with deep wrinkles in the back of his neck. The brown blotches of the benevolent skin cancer the sun brings from its reflection on the tropic sea were on his cheeks. The blotches ran well down the sides of his face, and his hands had the deep creased scars from handling heavy fish on the cords. But none of these scars were fresh. They were as old as erosions in a fishless desert. Everything about him was old, except his eyes, and they were the same color as the sea, and were cheerful and undefeated. "Santiago," the boy said to him as they climbed the bank from where the skiff was hauled up, "I could go with you again. We've made some money." The old man had taught the boy to fish, and the boy loved him. "No," the old man said. "You're with a lucky boat. Stay with them." "But remember how you went 87 days without fish, and then we caught big ones every day for 3 weeks?" "I remember," the old man said. "I know you did not leave me because you doubted."
William Roberts narrating The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Charlie McAsee, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
It's a real pleasure. I hope I've made sense in things I've said. I'm aware that sometimes I don't. But if you do listen to the audiobook, I hope you enjoy it. And I hope it gives you pleasure and peace and comfort in these times. Thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for in this special Christmas edition of Read On. But don't forget to tune in over the festive season to hear a snow-themed episode on the 28th of December and our 2-hour retrospective on 2020 in books on New Year's Day. As always, the show is available to download as a podcast. Simply search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSail, which is RedSZell, and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Thanks to all my guests, to stand-in producer Hannah, and to all of you for listening. We'll be back in the new year, but meanwhile, Merry Christmas, everybody, and don't forget to read on.